You're listening to Descent Magazine's Belabored podcast, hosted by Sarah Jaffe and Michelle Chen.
Hey, Sarah.
Hi, Michelle.
And welcome to Belabored episode 113. We are talking to Sarah Chambers of the Chicago Teachers Union, talking about the possibility of a strike coming up soon and what it means for Chicago's teachers, its schools, and its politics. But first, the news. New York City may soon be the next city to take the fight for 15 to the next level, with a legislative proposal to give workers not just more take-home pay, but a more decent workplace by ensuring more stable and consistent hours and fair schedules. As part of a national movement called the Fair Work Week Initiative, it was spearheaded by a coalition of labor and community groups, including the Center for Popular Democracy, as well as a few community labor alliances. And it's about ensuring not just that you get paid this much an hour, but that your hours are arranged on a stable enough basis to ensure that you are able to do things in life other than work. See, it's not just the low pay, but it's the hours that can really kill you when you're a salesperson and you don't know whether you're working 1 hour this week or 30 hours this week, and you have to be ready at any point to, at the drop of a hat, respond to your boss calling you up for an extra shift. Mayor Bill de Blasio and city council members have just announced legislation designed to set standards for more predictable scheduling at large fast food outlets in the city. So the soon-to-be-introduced bill would, according to the mayor's office, quote, require fast food employers to schedule a majority of expected shifts and publicly post a workplace schedule 2 weeks in advance. It doesn't sound like a particularly radical change, but it can make a difference in the everyday lives when it means you get to, say, plan for childcare or arrange college classes around your normal work hours. But the bill would affect an estimated 65,000 fast food workers, which is not insignificant, but still it leaves out the massive retail and full-service restaurant sectors, which are some of the hugest employers in the area of low-wage service labor that operates on pretty erratic hours. And if anyone's ever worked a night shift at a restaurant for tipped wages, they know what I'm talking about. Nationwide, roughly 17% of workers operate on so-called volatile schedules. Young workers are also especially affected. One nationwide survey of workers in their late 20s and early 30s found that of those who work in retail, about 50% of them were not informed of what their work schedule would be more than a week in advance. Seattle has just passed similar legislation for large retailers and full-service restaurants in the city, and it mandates that employers post schedules 2 weeks in advance and pay overtime for hours lost from unexpected shift cancellations or rescheduling. It has also barred the scheduling of back-to-back shifts fewer than 10 hours apart, so this would combat the issue of the dreaded clopening that Starbucks popularized before it was forced to at least promise to reform the measure under public pressure. But basically, this is when you're on call to close the shop at night, and then you wake up basically 4 hours later, and then you have to be back on the job to reopen the shop the next day. So it's pretty brutal. But aside from clopenings, there are a lot of dirty ways that retailers try to either short you on your hours or jerk your schedule around. And San Francisco actually got ahead of the game by passing the Retail Workers Bill of Rights, which aims specifically at workers in retail stores. And it allows for more transparent scheduling rules and gives workers the power to negotiate their hours and to gain access to full-time positions at their workplaces. But of course, with all these rules, enforcement is always a major issue. And in some cases, this can be more difficult to enforce than a straight-up minimum wage law, because it's not just one single wage standard you're talking about. There are no, payroll stubs that are there to serve as evidence. It's really about negotiating power within the workplace and all the social dynamics therein. And of course, when you're a low-paid, precarious worker, there's often a very difficult road to hoe. But with any luck, New York and Seattle and now San Francisco, these three cities are going to sort of show the way in terms of how to make the Fair Work Week as normal a part of everyday work life as the minimum wage. And I spoke to Carrie Gleason at the Center for Popular Democracy about the new policy and whether it signifies a trend in cities across the country, as well as what companies are doing on their own.
Similar to,
wages and earned sick time, different cities and states are considering a range of proposals around work hours. And when we're seeing companies right now, when, you know, when they had to begin complying with San Francisco's law, we saw companies across the country start to adopt similar policies for, you know, nationally, you know, so companies that had to start to provide 2 weeks advance notice of work schedules in San Francisco, we saw a movement towards them providing 2 weeks advance notice across the country. So I think, you know, I think that we're going to see a similar effect across the board. And I think a lot of companies are trying to get ahead of the curve. They don't want, you know, negative media attention. And, you know, I think are also becoming increasingly aware that, you know, employees' work schedules are out of line with their values and their goals for their business. And so, you know, I think we are seeing a lot of employers start to look to see what they can do on their own and make improvements on schedules.
2 weeks ago, while Michelle was interviewing our guests about India, I was in North Dakota visiting the camp set up to block the Dakota Access Pipeline. I was there at the same time as union members and organizers with Communications Workers of America, National Nurses United, and the Labor-Affiliated Working Families Party, who were also visiting to show support. But of course, the unions that are working on the pipeline have another view of the situation, and they are not pleased with the fact that other parts of the labor movement have sided with the water protectors. Climate change and the battles around it have continued to be a sticking point for the labor movement, as we discussed on our very first Belabored Live back in 2014, which was episode 61. When the AFL-CIO put out a statement taking the side of the construction unions, the Teamsters, LIUNA, the Operating Engineers and United Association, and urging the continuation of pipeline construction, protests used the framing of a picket line to call for labor to respect the blockade of the people of the Standing Rock Reservation. CWA, United Electrical Workers, NNU, and others have put out statements of support for the blockade, and still others have called for the AFL-CIO to reverse its position. Meanwhile, statements from LIUNA and others criticize the lack of solidarity from the unions who are against the pipeline, implying that they essentially should either support other unions or stay out of it entirely. Like the struggle around police unions, labor finds itself caught in the middle of a thorny issue of deep importance to historically marginalized people in this situation, where Native people oppose the construction under their water source and have seen sacred places and burial grounds dug up by pipeline crews. Yet climate change is an issue that labor knows it has to act on. There's a history of workers in energy production organizing for environmental justice, as Dissent has covered several times. But in a rough economy, it can be hard to turn away from any job. Still, the question of solidarity and rebuilding the labor movement has to mean more than just solidarity with whatever another union is doing. It has to mean labor seeing itself as a force for all people, not just narrow member interests, without sacrificing the good of its immediate members. We will, of course, keep talking about this issue on the podcast. We all, of course, look forward to hearing from you on this. You can email us at belabored@dissentmagazine.org. We would love to talk more about what labor can do with climate. Maybe we'll talk about this on a joint episode with our sister podcast, Hot and Bothered.
In the so-called knowledge economy of Silicon Valley, the industry behind all those bits and bytes is supported by a massive frontline labor force that often seldom gets the accolades that software engineers get all the time. But it's really the drivers, janitors, and cafeteria workers who do more to keep the place running than most people recognize. Now they're organizing for representation at work and for fair wages and working conditions. Recently at Intel's Santa Clara headquarters, the cafeteria workers voted to join Unite Here Local 19. The victory capped a months-long organizing drive during which the union filed a federal complaint alleging various anti-union interference by management. The third-party contractor that employs the workers, Eurest, was also accused of violating state regulations by restricting workers' bathroom breaks. Another victory came when drivers at the Silicon Valley shuttle bus operator Bowers, which services Cisco, Intuit, and other big tech firms, voted to join the Teamsters. The unionization of the Bowers drivers follows other similar union votes at shuttle operators across the Bay Area. They tend to work for companies like Facebook and other big tech firms that need, you know, luxury shuttles instead of the dirty, nasty municipal bus to bring their workers to and from their suburban enclaves into the big city every day. So the vote was especially contentious for Bowers. It led to some high-profile protests at, where else but, uni bus stops. And it caused so much disruption that it was one of the major reasons that the local transit authority passed a mandate that required all permitted private bus operators to achieve, quote-unquote, labor harmony. This means that Bowers was threatened with losing its permit if it did not resolve the labor dispute. Over the past year, Bowers has been accused by the Teamsters of various shady union-busting tactics. These include setting up a fake company union and coercing workers into signing essentially blank contracts in order to preempt organizing with an actual union and suppressing wages. Instead, the workers thought better of it and chose the Teamsters, and now they look forward to negotiating a contract that would put them on par with the other tech shuttle drivers that gives them some decent benefits and a pay of about $30 an hour. Of course, while unionization is undoubtedly a boost for private bus drivers working for Silicon Valley, the whole phenomenon of the so-called Google bus, big tech firms chartering their own shuttles through these third-party contractors, it actually raises a lot of tensions in the community as a whole because it raises the specter of privatization of the transport system. The shuttle system alone carries about 34,000 riders a day, according to one recent study, and that's a huge increase from just a few years ago. But labor advocates hope that by improving working conditions for these private shuttle drivers, that might have a knock-on effect in other sectors as well. For instance, the paratransit drivers, whom the Teamsters also represents, they're also getting a better wage offer as a result, in part, they say, because of the upwards pressure that is exerted by the tech firms' union contracts. So we'll see if there's a broader ripple effect across the transportation infrastructure. Doug Block, political director of Teamsters Joint Council 7, talked to me about the meaning of the city's intervention in this labor dispute with the tech shuttle drivers, and also what it means in the long run to have so much of the city's transit infrastructure and its workforce, including their own drivers, controlled by private operators, catering to an exclusive, affluent set of riders. Is that really sustainable? And what's the role of organized labor in promoting a more equitable system for all?
It was a long process. Started out well over a year ago when we started talking to the drivers, and then it appeared that management was involved in organizing ultimately what the NLRB decided was a company union. That union was disbanded. We went back for another, actually it was really our first election with the workers, which we narrowly lost. We filed charges after that around things like, for example, one of the workers was fired a week before the election and other things that happened that we believe tainted the outcome of the election. And the NLRB issued a complaint around all of these activities that had been going on. We still had things pending before the NLRB when the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency decided to deny Bowers a new permit based in part on operational issues the company was having and also because they didn't have labor harmony, which is a requirement of the permit program that the MTA has with all the different shuttle bus companies. You know, we had multiple demonstrations over the course of this campaign where we were out there, we were disrupting Bowers buses, and it doesn't take very long during rush hour traffic in San Francisco, you know, to back up traffic. The MTA's interest was not really to wade into our labor relations, but to make sure that if there are labor disputes with these private shuttle bus companies that are using the public bus stops, that that doesn't interfere with the regular buses that hundreds of thousands of people ride every day in San Francisco. These shuttle buses, these so-called Google buses, are running all over the nine counties of the Bay Area. And the MTA is the only transit agency that has actually gone out there to regulate them. We have systematically underfunded public transit. And now we have a situation where you have private companies moving people, their employees, in an area with high housing costs, with bad transportation infrastructure, including public transit, who have gone the route of creating their own transit system to move their employees. And on the one hand, you can say that's really good. It's getting cars off the road. It's good for the environment, and kudos to them for doing that. On the other hand, you have to say, well, we don't have public buses. We don't have trains. We don't have light rail. We don't have other alternatives for people. And every rider we put in a Google bus is somebody who's not putting money into a fare box. So it's, in some ways, it's solving a problem. In other ways, it's exacerbating the problem. We do not get behind privatization. You know, we always support public workers, and we're sort of the fallback when work gets privatized.
The multi-state prison strike on which we reported last episode is continuing, and the most exciting news, speaking of questions of solidarity and jobs, may have been that correctional officers at the Holman Correctional Facility in Alabama, where the strike got started, acted in solidarity with the prisoners. Belabored spoke with a retired correctional officer from Holman who preferred we not use his name, and he filled us in on the details and the conditions in Holman.
First, tell me, I know you worked at Holman for a long time. What were some of the labor issues that you faced while you were there?
Overall, it's labor shortage more than anything.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of that, in my opinion, and as well as a lot of others' opinions, is because of the rate of pay compared to the national average, as well as the fact that most of your higher-ups, like from the captain on up through warden, associate commissioners, and so forth, they really do not have as much of a concern as we feel they should have for us. It's more about what they can do to save face for the department or satisfy the inmate.
Yeah. And when you say the rate of pay compared to the national average, you mean it's below national average?
It's way below national average.
So how does the understaffing affect your safety in that job?
Potential for death, as far as the number of officers that can respond to a situation, be it, you know, just a minor altercation or, say, a major riot. I mean, on average, they say that there should be somewhere in the neighborhood of, well, if you actually met the standards, by correctional standards, you would have to have around 50 officers a shift.
Yeah.
And when I left, there was around 25 to each shift. And now, as my understanding, they might have 35 throughout the whole camp for all shifts.
People are talking, of course, about the prisoners' strike that's going on, and that the officers at Holman were off the job the other day and were expressing solidarity with the prisoners' action. Can you tell me more about that?
Actually, they did not show up for work because it was prearranged through the powers to be in Montgomery that they could take off to lay a officer to rest that died in the line of duty. You know, it wasn't a per se labor strike or we're not coming to work because we want better conditions. And honestly, Montgomery dropped the ball on that, and they didn't have near enough officers showing up for the number of officers it took off.
But some of the complaints that that you and the other officers have about the conditions there are sort of similar and in common with some of the demands that the prisoners are making, right?
To my understanding, they are.
To your understanding, what are the similarities?
Well, the first one being safety and overall safety of a person's, you know, well-being or whatever, as far as being protected from someone that may decide they want to kill somebody or someone that may decide they want to get a group together to take over the, you know, the prison or whatever. Some of your lower, I guess you would say lower class inmates or whatever, that they feel threatened or they feel unsafe and feel like they're not protected adequately. And, you know, a lot of officers also feel the same way. there's not enough there to take care of a major situation if something was to happen.
And is the prison itself overcrowded?
It is about 250% overcrowded.
Oh, my goodness. And
they built a 200-man SEG unit. I don't know exactly what year that unit was built, but they built a 200 segregation cell unit. I'm going to guess and say about 10 years ago. And before then, it's my understanding that the camp was actually originally designed to hold, I think it was 448. If you add 200 to that, that would be 648. And right now, their count probably ranges between 985 and 1,010, which is at least 30 to 40% over.
In terms of, you know, what the strikers would like to see change and what you would like to see change, what are some of the solutions people are offering?
Well, they really haven't offered anything other than they're wanting to build four super-sized prisons to take the place of a lot of these older aging facilities. But the older aging facilities would be fine if they had adequate staff, which we feel like would come with better pay, better benefits, and they keep changing the retirement system from what it originally was when I started. I think it's changed twice to where now it's more like a 401k. And if you lose your money, you just lost it. Where before, the system I was in that I retired under, the money was there regardless. Once it was banked, it was there.
What do you hope people take away from seeing the prisoners go on strike?
Well, one thing, demonstrations or protests, they can be done peacefully. They don't have to be done violently. Mm-hmm. And another thing, I mean, the prisoner's not getting paid.
Right.
Well, you know, at the same time, they may not be getting paid, but they do have medical care, they have clothing, they have food, though I will say it's not the best food in the world.
Yeah.
But at the same time, do I feel like they need something? I mean, yeah, I think it would give them a little bit of a edge if they could earn so much, you know, on a cut rate, taking away the fact that, you know, they're provided those other amenities, just so that they could have money on their books, so to speak, to buy things that the state doesn't provide, like personal hygiene stuff and like that.
And that was our guest, a former correctional officer from Alabama, and we will keep up with the story of the prison strike. Our very first belabored episode dealt with the aftermath of the Chicago Teachers Union strike, where we interviewed CTU President Karen Lewis. It is a subject we've returned to many times, and we return to again this week. I was in Chicago this week as the announcement came that 95% of the voting members, some 86% or so of total members of the Chicago Teachers Union, once again voted to authorize a potential strike. This comes on the heels of a strike vote last year that also got very high levels of approval, and a one-day strike that brought other workers around the city out in solidarity. Sarah Chambers is a teacher at Maria Salcedo Scholastic Academy in Chicago and a member of CORE, the caucus that led the successful 2012 strike. I sat down with her to discuss the struggles that CTU still faces and what might bring about yet another strike.
So you guys voted to strike last year, but redid the vote and got a pretty impressive turnout this time.
Yeah, so we got 95% of our members voted yes, which is very strong percent.
Yeah.
So that shows our unity and strength, you know, against ROM and the board and kind of the powers that be. I don't think any of us were surprised. I mean, the conditions and the neoliberal education reform has really hit us hard.
Yeah.
And so teachers have said enough. We've been in bargaining for 456 days now.
Yeah.
And, you know, we weren't really getting where we wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And our strongest force is withholding our labor. So.
And so there was a vote, I think, last night, as we're recording this, on when the strike would start if there's still not a contract.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty soon, huh?
Yeah, so just, well, it's October 11th, so in about a couple weeks.
Yeah.
And Yeah, so we're just preparing now. We have our contract action teams in our schools. So I know for my school, I have at least 10 members on my contract action team, and those will turn into strike leaders.
Yeah.
They'll be leading the strike. But, you know, we're still bargaining up until October 11th. Yeah. We'll literally probably be bargaining right until, you know, midnight or 1 or 2 a.m. or right before the strike.
Yeah.
So that will be intense. We ideally want to settle before the strike.
Yeah.
But if we can't settle before then we will be out.
Yeah. So last year, when you took the strike vote, it did not lead to a prolonged strike. There was just the April 1st action, which I talked to you about then. So, yeah, tell us about sort of the decision-making there to do the short strike and then this time looking at a more prolonged strike. Right?
So April 1st was really around getting revenue, and specifically progressive revenue.
Right.
You know, the board and ROM have always been proposing cuts, and they just keep getting more further in debt every year. Where at least 10% of CPS budget is now debt,
right?
Just paying off creditors, and it's just getting worse and worse. And, you know, in the spring, it was looking really bad. We were looking at, you know, there's discussions of ending the school year early because they had no money, or that they wouldn't start in the fall.
Yeah.
And so we were pushing for progressive revenue down at the Illinois legislature.
Right.
And our strike was very successful. We actually won a pension tax levy that brought $200 million extra into our pensions, which is huge.
Yeah.
And we got $600 million out of the legislature to actually start school on time. So it was a successful strike.
It's amazing that you have to strike to get school to start on time.
Yeah, sad.
When I think about the story that, like, ROM and the state legislature will tell about it, it's that, you know, teachers are lazy and they don't care, and then the teachers are literally going on strike to make sure that school starts.
Yep, I mean, to be frank, you know, the Board of Education is appointed by Rahm Emanuel. Almost all of their kids don't go to public schools, so they don't really care if school starts on time.
Yeah. Yeah. So can you talk about what these proposed budget cuts would mean for your students and your communities? What does it look like when they lay off another 1,000 teachers?
I mean, even now with the budget cuts they've made over the past couple years, we can really feel it. Our schools are bare bones.
Right.
You know, we have a counselor. Most schools only have one counselor that has no time to counsel because all they do is test prep.
Right.
Most schools have a nurse there maybe one day a week. My school has 1,200 students with a nurse there twice. So then teachers have to ask, like, nurses and give out medicine and stuff they're not really certified to do.
Yeah.
Class sizes are exploding. There's some kindergartens around the city that have 50 students in class.
And 50 kindergartners.
Yes.
Which
is a fire hazard, first of all. The second of all,
like, on the basic level,
you can't, I mean, that's not, how can you teach with that many students in a class?
Yeah.
And, you know, these cuts are hurting the kids. They're really, really hurting the kids. And they're hurting us, too. You know, they want to cut our pay drastically.
Yeah.
But how I see it, they're just trying to destroy the public schools. And these strikes are to save our public schools.
Yeah. Yeah, and so when they announced the most recent layoffs, I noticed that some familiar names were among the people laid off.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that this was, you know, deliberate?
Yeah, I mean, they're targeting many of our members who are our most active members. For example, Shion Franzinger Barrett, he's a friend of mine. He actually just had a baby a week ago. He was laid off again, I think, the third time.
Yeah.
And it's because he's an amazing teacher, has a ton of awards, and he's a great student organizer. And his students sometimes are the most vocal students, kind of very critical students on what's going on, and that challenges the Board of Education and the other powers.
Yeah.
You know, and they also laid off Tim Meegan, who ran for city council.
Yeah.
So they target the ones that are active.
Yeah. What are still the sticking points in the bargaining here?
I mean, there's a lot of issues, because some issues are also teachers being treated as professionals.
Right.
You know, right now, it's like businessmen and these neoliberal reformers are trying to dictate education, and they have no teaching degrees, they know nothing about education, and they're trying to control what we do with massive amounts of testing, and they're using the test to close our schools and open up charters. So it's also a fight about teachers being treated with respect, and teachers, you know, having more control over the classrooms because we are the ones with professionals with degrees. Yep. And another one is stopping privatization. Yeah. You know, we're pushing right now for contract articles. There says a moratorium on charters, a moratorium on closures.
Yeah.
And, you know, they keep trying to work in these loopholes to try to get around that. But this is what our city needs and our community needs.
Yeah. Speaking of the community needs. Last time we talked a little bit about the shooting of Laquan McDonald and the way teachers have gotten involved in those kinds of fights in the city. Are there particular issues around racial justice, policing, anything like that that's being discussed right now?
Yes, I mean, right now, because they keep cutting our counselors and social workers, they're not dealing with the trauma that these students have. They've also slashed all the extracurricular activities.
Yeah.
So, you know, if students are out in the streets and if they're not having, you know, support for their trauma and having this counseling, then that causes more violence in the neighborhood. So we are pushing for smaller caseloads for our social workers, more social workers and counselors, and restorative justice coordinators.
Yeah.
We don't want schools just suspending the students or, you know, even expelling students. We want them to have these support groups, and restorative justice coordinators have proven to be very effective.
Yeah.
And often more effective than police in many of these schools.
So at the same time that there are all these budget cuts being proposed, people are pushing back and saying, you know, we want major funding. You know, you guys were fighting for new tax revenue. What is the argument that the legislature, that ROM, that these other people sort of make against funding the schools fairly?
They just keep saying, oh, we have no money, we have no money, that, you know, we need to make these cuts. But there is money.
Yeah.
I mean, we are in the richest country, you know, in history in the USA.
Yeah.
They're funding wars to a ridiculous amount. And in Illinois, you know, we have a flat tax.
Right.
So the millionaires are paying the same percentage as poor people, and that's not fair. If we had, you know, progressive tax rates, then we wouldn't be in this situation.
Yeah.
If we had a millionaire's tax, that's a major one we're pushing, where there, it was just a tax on millionaires, we wouldn't be in this situation. Or if we taxed a 1 cent tax on every trade financial transaction, that would also bring millions and millions of dollars.
Yeah.
So ROM and our governor, Rauner, are choosing not to fund the schools.
Yeah.
You know, they want to have the schools in chaos. They could tax their rich buddies, but they don't want to.
Yeah. And so last time around it was ROM, and certainly there's still the state legislature wasn't exactly friendly, but it's a totally different picture with Bruce Rauner in the governor's mansion in Illinois. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, we are still pushing for, you know, some money from Springfield, from our state legislature. You know, Rauner is a union buster. His goal is to really break the unions. And so we are pushing a lot of progressive revenue down in Springfield. And we're also pushing for elected school board down in Springfield. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, last year it passed, the legislation passed through the House 110-4. So if it passed through the Senate, we won't have to deal with this appointed board anymore.
Yeah.
But, you know, the fight is with the city council, but it's also down in Springfield. So we're fighting for revenue in both areas.
Do you feel like the political atmosphere has changed even since last spring? Does it feel like people are really waking up to the seriousness of sort of what kinds of things Bruce Rauner is proposing?
I mean, people have really felt the cuts around the state, so people know the seriousness of it. Our neighborhoods are really struggling. A lot of community organizations as well have had their funding cut.
Yeah.
And so I think people are really waking up and saying, hey, we need to fight this governor, you know, and we also need to push our state reps to pass this revenue as well.
Yeah.
But we did very well in the primaries, so that kind of shows our strength and with the community organizations and that they're fighting back. So
yeah.
Hopefully we'll be winning more of these victories after November election.
Talk about sort of the political work that you've done, and we talked about Tim Meaghan a little bit. When we're thinking about both the national and the local political picture, what does it mean to sort of do political work as a union in Chicago?
Well, we're, you know, doing trainings and supporting our own members running for city council, you know, even people from the community running for state representative. We started Chicago Teachers Union and some other unions and community organizations started United Working Families.
Yeah.
which kind of acts somewhat, we're trying to push it as a third party, mm-hmm. and it does training. So, for example, it helped Sue Garza mm-hmm. win her election in city council, yeah. and it really helped with all these primaries. We're pushing a lot of the progressive candidates,
yeah.
and we're going to continue to do so. I mean, we're only gaining strength here in the city and around the state, so I imagine with every election, we're going to win more candidates. And yeah. you saw with Chewy for the mayoral race, yeah. he really embarrassed Rahm when he got him into a runoff.
That is kind of the question, right? It was, I'm thinking back to the 2012 strike and, you know, how shocking it was that, you know, the union just really bashed Rahm down. But then, of course, he turns around and closes 50 schools. And so do you feel like this time around, there's sort of more awareness of other things besides winning this contract that have to be done?
I mean, there's really a struggle for the whole city. You know, all the money has been kind of funneling into downtown, into wealthy areas,
yeah.
and it's been like that for a long time in the city. And the South and West Sides have gotten ignored, the public services have gotten ignored, so there's been really a lot of attention on bringing money back to these social services. And so we've been, you know, also fighting for clinics, for free clinics, for libraries in the neighborhoods. There are things such as CPAC, the Civilian Police Accountability Council, to help mm-hmm. with safety and violence in the neighborhoods. So we are looking at bigger picture, you know. Yeah. It's all these, how the neighborhoods are and these social services affect all our students.
Yeah.
So we have to look bigger picture for our students' sake.
Yeah. Talk about some of the alliances that have formed since the last strike with community groups, other unions. How has that grown and how is it continuing to grow around this contract fight?
I mean, even if you see from the April 1st strike, even during the marches, mm-hmm. I would say around 40 to 50% of people marching were supporters, were community groups, were people from the neighborhoods, because they know that we're standing up for what's right, and, you know, we're also standing against the 1%, the ones that are hurting our neighborhoods. And that's only grown. I mean, this summer in Chicago, there are protests every week, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it just keeps growing and growing, and the alliances are getting stronger. And I definitely believe we'll see that for this upcoming strike. It's going to be stronger than 2012. Rahm's polling as well is way weaker. Mm-hmm. He's kind of the laughing stock of the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
And so I think we're a bigger force to be reckoned with.
What's it been like in your school while this is all going on? You know, what's the day to day?
You know, it can definitely be stressful.
Yeah.
Just because the class sizes are bigger, because of all the cuts, you have to do more with less.
Yeah.
And they're trying to, you know, really burden us with tons of paperwork. They're trying to get teachers basically to leave the system is their goal. My school had 15 teachers leave over the summer. It's kind of a mass exodus.
Yeah.
Special education teachers have been leaving in droves around the city. Certain schools at Roosevelt, they had 7 special education teachers leave, almost the entire department, because of the atrocities CPS is committing
yeah.
against our students. So it can be hard, you know. It can definitely be hard in the schools, but teachers are also ready to say enough is enough and let's get on the offensive and let's win these demands to make yeah. our schools better.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's what you saw from the 95% vote.
Yeah. Talk about what you've seen since the 2012 strike in terms of teachers' unions around the country and the influence that CTU has had when you look out and see, like, the Seattle teachers
yeah.
or, you know, other places like that and see what kind of impact it had.
Yeah, I mean, after 2012, there were really strikes all over the place. Within Illinois, there were a number of strikes around the country. You know, Seattle had their strike. Portland was going to go on
yeah.
strike, and the night before they, you know, stopped, but they did take the strike vote.
Uh-huh.
People call me even from all over the world to Chicago to really talk to us about how did we organize for this, prepare for this, because Chicago is one of the central hubs for neoliberal education reform.
Right.
So I think that's why all eyes look on Chicago.
Yeah.
So they think, okay, if they can take us down, then they think they can take everyone else down. So, you know, we had teachers come to Chicago from Japan studying what's going on here because
yeah.
they're in similar fights over there, you know, with budget cuts and They even have students cleaning their schools instead of custodial staff. So it's happening.
Didn't Newt Gingrich like suggest that as a thing once? And like that's actually, wow.
I'm sure. Yeah. Anyway. So it's happening all over the world.
Oh my goodness.
But, you know, I think also the uprisings are spreading around the country.
Yeah.
That's what we want to see. We're hoping, you know, also other sectors will pick it up. There's a chance that the charter school teachers here might strike,
mm-hmm.
which I think might be the first charter strike in history that I know of.
Yeah.
That would be huge. That would be at a number of schools, UNO schools.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. And just in terms of, like, the political, it seems like since 2012 there's been a real shift in public opinion around the country around, like, the neoliberal education reform project in general.
Mm-hmm. I think before people didn't really have a name for it and didn't know what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And now I think it's very, very clear to teachers and I think even parents around the country, they see what neoliberal reform is. With starting with school choice, excessive testing, using the data to close the schools, opening charters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you see Detroit or Philly, they're over 50% charters now. New Orleans has no public schools left. Yeah. It's spread around the country, so you can't really ignore it anymore.
Yeah. Talk about, I mean, I know CORE started as a reading group. Talk about the importance of actually, like, putting a name on this and connecting it to a political system.
I think you mean in terms of a caucus?
Yeah, just in terms of saying, like you said, like people didn't really know what to call it before.
I think people have to look big picture. You know, people might just focus on one aspect of these attacks that they don't like. So maybe they just don't like these excessive testing. You have to connect it overall. What is the plan by the 1% that's happening around the world? And you'll see it other places. For example, in places in Europe, they just started with school choice, mm-hmm. and they're just starting with charters, they're called academies over there, right? So you got to connect all the dots so you know overall how to fight back, not just one aspect of neoliberal reform, but all the different aspects.
Yeah. Talk about the work that goes on and has gone on since the beginning within the schools to get the teachers, you know, on the same page and ready for strike and ready to have, you know, big picket lines and things like that going, you know.
So I think a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of people who've written books or articles about the strikes, but then
guilty as charged.
but then people don't talk about what actually, how did we get to this point?
Yeah.
And how much organizing it's taken? Because there's other cities that have tried to replicate it, but they didn't know the actual groundwork it took to build this movement.
Yeah.
So, for example, even within the schools, starting these committees, these contract action teams, we have representatives from various grade levels and of various races and ages and strong representation, where you start off by having just these discussions. You know, back in the day, people didn't know what a charter was. So maybe your first discussion is, what is a charter school? What does privatization look like? And then you grow to small actions, like wearing a button or like wearing red on Fridays.
Mm-hmm.
And then you grow to bigger actions, like a community forum, or passing out flyers outside to parents, and then that eventually would turn into organizing for the strike and having them talk to their individual team members and making sure you can get that strong vote. Because without organizing in that way at the school, at the ground level, we would have never been able to get this high of a vote.
Yeah.
And that was Sarah Chambers with the Chicago Teachers Union.
You're listening to Belabored, a Dissent Magazine podcast. Links to articles mentioned in this episode may be found at dissentmagazine.org.
And now it's time for Arg, I wish I'd written that. My pick is a Critic at Large piece by Akash Kapoor in New Yorker, and it is called Return of the Utopians. So it starts with a bit of the history of utopia as both a concept and a political and social project, as well as a cultural phenomenon. Kapoor writes of a so-called, quote, rejuvenated Marxism that inspires modern utopian visions as something that is both very modern and very old-fashioned. He writes, in fact, Marx and Engels were dismissive of 19th century bourgeois utopian socialism, contrasting it with their own scientific socialism. Yet many of the principles championed by these communities, collectivism, egalitarianism, the rejection of capitalism and individualism, reflect a softer version of communism, what Benjamin Kunkel has described as Marxish thought. When you put this in historical context, you see that with every utopian vision, there are pluses and minuses. And of course, minuses are a big problem when you're aiming for utopia. And that, of course, undermines its very claim to perfection. But hey, who's counting? And you could say that utopias that seek to create utopia on Earth in the here and now, by definition, contain their very own counterclaim because their very existence, as isolated communities often involving just a few people and perhaps just one generation of people at the most, means that they are intrinsically limited and hence not very utopian in the sense that utopia is supposed to be universal and work for everyone. Often, utopias weren't even universally good for the people in them. See the example of Oneida, one of the early utopian communities in the United States during the 19th century. And he describes it as, quote, "The pursuit of perfectionism, as the doctrine was called, led to a number of unorthodox practices, notably, quote, complex marriage and sexual communism, which were essentially coinages for radical polyamory and free love. Utopia is very good at rebranding existing human behaviors." Underlying Oneida's quirky sexual norms was, in fact, a set of deeply progressive beliefs in collective ownership and equality, notably for women. So far, so good. But emancipating women's sexual and reproductive lives did not always yield the best outcomes for families or for romantic relationships, for that matter. In fact, Oneida basically abolished the conventional household as defined by 19th century standards, and it was actually pretty unconventional even by today's standards, and not necessarily in a super progressive way. Quote, "In Oneida, parents were separated from their young offspring in an effort to break attachments that could deviate from communal solidarity." Quote, "stickiness" in another Oneidan coinage. Children, passive receptacles for their parents' life choices, are always the worst victims of such communities. And then you get into shades of eugenicism and other sorts of ugly aspects of the more super ultra militantly idealistic utopias. And that, of course, led to all sorts of rather right-wing and extremist versions in the 20th century. Yikes! So the history of utopias, of course, doesn't have that much to do with the labor movement per se, except for the fact that both the labor movement and the utopian vision grow out of a certain socialist vision that predates even Marxism, and which Marxism reflected and tried to make material and concretize by grafting over the lived experiences and social dynamics of the industrial era and the plight of the working class. But while the Communist Manifesto, which is a utopian document, you might say, is required reading for any radical activists, the problem with most radical visions, including those of Marx, is that they never quite work as planned, and yet they are essentially nothing but the enactment of plans over and over again, generation after generation. Success and failure in the realm of utopian philosophical speculation is about a lot more than simply achieving utopia the thing. I mean, if it were just that, no one would even try. But we gain a sense of perfection in the striving for it. This is essential in terms of the project that Marx laid out, but the modern incarnation of Marxishism tends to divorce the specifics of the social or political program of working toward communism, because there have been some rather unfortunate experiments with that in the past, and instead to distill Marxist thought in a purest sense into an analytical system for critiquing society, and more specifically, critiquing contemporary capitalism, which does have its uses. I'll close with a conclusion about Oneida by historian Ellen Wayland Smith, which Kapoor cites. She writes about how it began as a collective society based on ultra-egalitarianism and strictly regulated, albeit ostensibly democratized, human relationships. It evolved into what else but a joint stock corporation. Quote, "Initially, the company tried to hold on to some vestiges of its founding idealism by paying more progressive wages, among other things. But the 1960s, when an efficiency expert was brought in and the company was listed on the New York Stock Exchange, even these trace principles were a distant memory. The 1980s and successive decades saw efforts to professionalize management and a string of acquisitions that loaded the company with debt." Sound familiar? Predictably, this all led to bankruptcy. In 2006, and the company's dissolution was accompanied, Wayland Smith writes, by the termination of one of its workers' pension plans. Oneida's founding idealism, she concludes, quote, had been made a mockery. And so it is with militant, idealistic collectives that later start to manufacture housewares and become joint stock corporations. That said, Kapur ends with some useful words about pragmatism as a counterpoint to radical utopia. He writes, "Surely these 19th century communities have much to teach us about daring to imagine alternatives, about interrupting what may seem like the ineluctable march of history. As always with utopia, the sentiment is irreproachable. But imagining is the easy part. It is what happens after the imagining, the movement from what Ernst Bloch called abstract utopia to concrete utopia, that is most concerning. Modern-day utopians are not blind to the lessons of history. Many of them see limits posed by human nature and recognize that utopia is always veered between evil and futility. But what if there were another way? What if lasting change could happen without all the violence and disillusionment and just sheer drama that always seems to accompany utopia?" Unquote. Well, I don't have any answers, but I suppose I'll conclude with a few words about what utopia seems to mean in the post-Occupy era in this rather unutopian election season. Oddly enough, you see much more utopian language nowadays in our popular culture from the right, with the florid and hyperbolic rhetoric of neoliberalism and free markets as the saviors of the world and the guarantees of universal freedom and justice. That, too, is a form of utopian thinking, you might say, albeit a flawed one. And if we are going to critique it on the merits, well, that's all to the good, but if we want to really explode the myth of neoliberalism as an answer to the world's problems, we better come up with an alternative. And if the left's alternative is going to be grounded in Marxism as a system of thought, then we should all think about humankind's long and at times disturbing history of seeking, finding, and failing at utopia in all its forms. We can, however, have utopianism perhaps without utopia itself. And likewise, even as we live in a world of compromise, we can still, in the here and now, in our world, do some pretty radical things.
In the conversation about police and police violence, some of the heat has also been aimed at 911 dispatchers, who make the decision, of course, to send police or first responders when they get a call. Yana Kunichoff has a piece up at Pacific Standard grappling with this issue and with the working conditions of those dispatchers. Dispatchers are in what may be the most stressful part of the chain and the one most likely to lead to long-term issues. They have to make split-second decisions to try to save lives and yet have next to no input as to what happens after they make a dispatch. What matters most to the telecommunicator is that everyone goes home safe, and yet it is the very thing over which they have no control, says Jim Marshall, who heads the 911 Wellness Foundation, a nonprofit aimed at supporting and improving the health of 911 dispatchers. Yana writes of some of the other stresses of the job, quote, "Dispatchers consistently complain about a lack of closure. Unlike a responder, dispatchers rarely find out whether a particular case was resolved. According to Paul Linné, who has both managed dispatch centers and been a dispatcher himself, the average dispatcher in Minneapolis, where he was the director of emergency communications, answered upwards of 150 calls each shift. They almost never found out what happened to any of them. While you were talking to this party, you may have developed some sort of bond," Linné says, "but you never know. Did you do the right thing? Did you do the best thing? How did it turn out?" End quote. One might guess that with increased attention to being paid these days to police killings, the stress of making the decision to send a police officer might be increasing too. And with budget cuts and a lack of emergency services in places like Chicago, where Yana spoke to a dispatch worker, it is that much harder for a 911 dispatcher to do anything about what happens to the people who are calling for help. Meanwhile, these same workers' labor, stop me if you've heard this one before, is considered less important than that of the people that they send out or other emergency responders. After the attacks of September 11th, the dispatch workers who took calls were denied mental health coverage by the city. Bad mental and emotional health can lead to bad decision-making on the job, which can lead to bad outcomes for the people on the other end of the phone. And that makes this an issue that affects us all. That is all for today's Belabored. Thanks once again to all of our listeners for supporting us. You can sign up at the Dissent website, dissentmagazine.org, to be a sustaining supporter of the podcast and get your excellent Belabored tote bag. We will put, as always, links to everything we've discussed on today's show up at the website. And as always, you can email us at belabored@dissentmagazine.org if you are a 911 dispatcher or a pipeline worker, if you're an adjunct or a bus driver, teacher, or a prison striker. You can also always tweet at us at hashtag belabored. Thanks again, and we will be back in 2 weeks.
You've been listening to Dissent Magazine's Belabored podcast. For the entire archive of past episodes, visit dissentmagazine.org. Join us online using hashtag belabored.